copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
This is a very large topic, and I'll just be discussing a slice of it that I personally find interesting. And there's a lot of other things which could be said, of course, as with all of these topics. Genomic evidence for common descent and how I see it fitting in with the broader faith science discussion. Okay. Firstly, this is the overview of what I'll be talking about, some introductory comments on the nature of the talk and the nature of common descent. Most of the talk will focus on some of the data, just a little piece of the data that I personally find interesting, briefly discuss some common arguments against common descent, and quickly highlight some responses from Christians that I find more helpful. And this is the very brief emoji summary of the talk, if the genetics is not your style. This is a very nice picture of a mouse embryo. There's a lot of these pictures which you can find with the Nikon Small World. It's a really impressive picture because I'll be discussing different kinds of mice as the focus of my data analysis. Okay, some introductory comments. What is this talk? Well, this is not a straightforward apologetics talk, unfortunately, although I do regularly give those and very much enjoy giving them. This instead is a presentation of evidence, which I think that scientific apologists should be aware of, and it develops my material from last year. I tend to think that guided evolution is true. I don't personally use the term theistic evolution as it's imprecise. And for some people, it comes with theological conclusions that I wouldn't necessarily want to make. When I first started exploring these things, I was really put off by the bad theology of people who had the label theistic evolution. And I don't want to align myself with everything that everyone who calls themselves a theistic evolutionist would want to say. This talk, though, is just about appreciating the evidence for common descent. And you can, of course, interpret that evidence in this talk as you like. My specific academic expertise within evolutionary genetics is in a few different things: microbial experimental evolution, which was my PhD topic from a few years ago. And since then, I've been working on gene annotation and gene origins in different microbes. Some notes on some terms and issues that have been raised in some last talks. Personally, I won't be using the word proof. I strongly dislike the word proof. I'm only dealing with evidence. It's really important, I think, that we're honest about open questions. All of the positions that we might hold to have various open questions, and we can't just cherry pick the data that fits with our position. Of course, it's very easy to do that. I think peer review is really helpful in this context. I think that's maybe one of the roles of this group, is to give feedback. There's a few people in this group who have at least as much expertise in this area as I do, and I look forward to some of their feedback. These topics are very complex. I've been researching them for the last 10 years, and I have just learned a small amount. I also want to say that common descent is not just accepted by evolutionists, which is one of these terms that gets thrown around. It's not, certainly not just accepted by neo-Darwinists. Some other people who accept common descent include people like Michael Behe, Gunter Bechli, Michael Denton, etc. So common descent is a fairly minimal view. It doesn't commit you to a bunch of other things regarding evolutionary processes, which in a lot of people's minds might be tied up together. Regarding the mitochondrial Eve issue, unfortunately, I don't have time to discuss it, but personally, I find this paper really helpful from my former advisor, Siegfried Scherer. He was, I think, one of the first people to write about this, and I really appreciate this paper's a really careful analysis. At the time, he was a young Earth creationist, but I just really appreciate how careful he was and what he was saying about that issue, which is really important. Okay, so what is a phylogenetic tree? Which is most of what I'll be discussing in this talk. Basically, as I see it, a phylogenetic tree is a visual representation of distances between organisms, calculated from a carefully defined set of traits or characteristics. It can be calculated from matrices, for instance, of morphological traits. And in this situation, in the ideal case, organisms sharing a trait will cluster together all else being equal, or at least they'll tend to cluster together. But now, of course, trees are typically calculated from DNA or protein sequence data rather than morphological traits. And this is an example. There's actually a bunch of features of the tree that I guess I could talk through. It shows the clustering, it shows the relative relationships. Just important to realize that the vertical distances don't mean anything, but the horizontal distances do for a standard phylogenetic tree. So I'll at least briefly mention once or twice the length of the different branches, which indicates the relative distances between the tips of the tree. Also want to say that phylogenetic trees are not just some theoretical construct evolutionists invented, but they're actually useful in current times. And people have been thinking about them quite a bit recently with SARS-CoV-2. We can use phylogenetic methods to trace the history of the virus as it spread throughout the world. We can see that viruses in the same location tend to be closely related to each other because they've arisen from a common ancestor. For instance, someone who flew into a different country and brought the virus with them. And these kinds of studies have been done a lot over the last year, of course. Some work that I was involved in is studying the different genes that are present in SARS-CoV-2. Some of them are controversial, whether they're actually genes or not. And it turns out that some of these genes are taxonomically restricted, the TRGs. This is a topic that I'll bring up later. But it's important to know, I guess, that some genes are only found in a very small proportion of genomes. They're not even found in all members of a species. So for instance, all of these genomes that are listed down here are actually part of what's technically the same virus species. So SARS-CoV-2 is just one version of a virus species, which includes the previous epidemic virus SARS coronavirus. So that's actually all part of the same virus species. And some of these genes are found in only a subset of the species. Now, some of these genes are controversial, but there's other accessory genes which are not at all controversial, which are also only found in a small number of coronaviruses. So they're found in, this gene, or 3D, if it's a true gene, it's found, so the black indicates a stop codon, so the full length open reading frame is only found in a small proportion of the tree. It's only found in this small taxonomical region. So other genomes in other parts of the tree don't have it. So this, the obvious inference here is that this gene arose relatively early. This is an example of a taxonomically restricted gene, which I'll discuss a little bit more later, and maybe we can talk more about in Q&A. This is the kind of thing which I've been researching over the last few years, a particular version of taxonomically restricted genes, which are overlapping genes. Also, I think important to keep in your mind is that we do see evolutionary processes in the labs. Evolutionary processes are also not just made up by evolutionists. This is a diagram of an experiment, which is quite famous, using a protocol called a megaplate, where in this case, so the dark region is a part of the plate that doesn't have bacteria growing in it. The light region is where bacteria has grown. At the start of the experiment, they just inoculated the plate down the ends here and down here with bacteria. And as you go towards the middle of the plate, there's more and more antibiotic concentration. So you can see this kind of stripes down here, because in each of these stripes, there's an increasing proportion of an antibiotic chemical. And over the course of, I think, a few days, the bacteria were able to grow and accumulate mutations. And some of the ones that accumulated a mutation that could grow in the first part under very weak antibiotic concentration were then able to grow in higher and higher concentrations. So this is evolution in action. And you can actually, with modern genome sequencing, you can go back and select this bacterium, and can see what mutations actually allowed it to grow under the higher and higher concentration of antibiotics. And then from this, you could also build a kind of a phylogenetic tree, which is what you kind of see here. So evolutionary processes do occur in the lab, not just single nucleotide polymorphisms, but in my PhD, We saw there's also more complex rearrangements, gene duplications or chromosome duplications, for instance. So evolution happens in a complicated way in microorganisms visible in the lab. Of course, it's an open question of how far we can go with that, and that will be the topic of my talk. So how far does it go? Of course, in biology, we have these different taxonomic rankings. We all know the species, and then a few different species will cluster together into what's called a genus, a few different genera into a family, into orders, classes, phyla, etc. And this talk will mostly focus on this grouping of taxonomic classes, just because I decided to focus on cute mammalian creatures that look like mice. And I'll be seeing what's the relationship between these different creatures, just as an example of the kind of data which evolutionists use to infer common descent from. So yeah, as I suggested, I guess maybe you don't care about viruses and bacteria, or you think that they're kind of different. Okay, they can evolve, but animals can't. Maybe you think they're different to us. So instead, I'll be focusing on mice and elephants in this talk. This is just a tree from Wikipedia. In this case, it's a cladogram. The branch lengths, the horizontal lengths don't actually matter. But the point of this tree is just to show the wide variety of different rodents which exist. And the mouse, the focus of this talk, the house mouse, is down here. And you'll see it's pretty closely related, according to this evolutionary scheme, to a rat, which is in a different genus, but a very closely related genus within the same family. And we can go outwards and get to more and more distant relatives, which share common ancestors in these ancestral nodes here. All of these are rodents. Okay, so you might think, well, a mouse is a mouse. What does this have to do with evolution? Well, it's not so clear what a mouse is. If you think that, for instance, God created separate kinds of animals, the question is, what was a kind? Which animals existing today are part of the same kind? This is a quote from Gene Leitner, who's a geneticist, I believe, with Answers in Genesis, just an example of what creationists have thought about this. I won't read the quote, but the point of it is that she decides that the appropriate level for the kind is the family, though in some ways she actually prefers the level of the order for the case of rodents. And this is also true for other mammalian and other animal groups as well. There's kind of an ongoing discussion among creationists, where is the level of the kind? Maybe it's different in different organisms, but it's not clear to this biologist, creationist, whether the kind should be set at the level of the family. I'll just go back here. Is it the level of the family or is it the level of the order? So this is at least interesting, I think. So the question really is there a separate mouse kind, or is the mouse and rat part of the same kind? And if we go to live the order, which is actually what she prefers, then it turns out that the mouse, the rat, and the porcupine would be part of the same kind, that we're descended from a common ancestor a few thousand years ago. So the question is, if evolution is simply a lie, if it's just made up, or if it's not real, then why is working out the kind so difficult? And what the evolutionist, the some person who believes in common descent, will say is that, well, animal life has a nested hierarchy without clear boundaries, and that fits with the idea of evolution. And that's why people like Charles Darwin came to the conclusion of common descent, was because it seems a natural inference from the fact of the nested hierarchy of life. I'm sure, of course, this will be controversial, and I look forward to discussing it with you. You might say, okay, I don't really care what a mouse is. Why should we care? Well, this has implications for common ancestry with regards to humans. Are humans related to chimpanzees? Well, it turns out that the difference between a mouse, musculus here, and a rat is pretty similar to the amount of difference that we see between humans and some other apes. Humans and chimpanzees are actually thought to have diverged relatively recently, similar amount of time as the different species in the mouse genus mice diverged. And they have, I think, roughly similar amounts of genetic diversity. Actually, in some ways, for people who know these kinds of comparison plots, the diversity in the mouse kind is more. So we see a bunch of different rearrangements. These are the red dots occurring between the different kinds of mice. And we see also they have different, so this is, yeah, this is the part of the plot I want to focus on. We see they also have different numbers of chromosomes. Even different mouse species within the genus mice have different numbers of chromosomes. So a lot of people would assume, well, okay, if you have a different number of chromosomes, surely you're a different kind, but it's not as simple as that. At least this is as far as I can work it out. So this is a really interesting paper from a couple of years ago where they sequenced a couple of new mouse genomes and they can do this kind of comparison. Okay, so a mouse is a mouse, or is it? What is a mouse? If you look at these different creatures, it might be hard to work out if you're kind of thinking in a kind mindset. Where's the level of the kind? What's a mouse? Where does a mouse stop and something else begin? You might think, well, maybe the first four are mice, but then this one down here, this one looks remarkably like a mouse. You might think. So it turns out this is the house mouse. This is a different species of mouse, Mus spratus. This is a different genus within the same family. This is a mouse of some kind, which is within a different family. This one is actually within a different order. It's quite closely related to a rabbit. This one is in a different superorder. It's actually remarkably different, as we'll come to soon. These ones are both marsupials. This one actually, it looks a bit more like a fox. It actually hunts mice, hunts marsupial mice like this one. This one looks remarkably like a mouse, but it's actually much more closely related to a koala than it is to a mouse, which I find remarkable. So the diversity, and evolutionists will appreciate that the diversity of mouse-like mammals makes sense if the common ancestor of mammals was small and rodent-like, as has been proposed. So again, the difficult question is, how far does it go? We see the nested hierarchy within rodents. This is a full tree of a bunch of different rodent species, which was published a couple of years ago, and just showing some of the different species. And I'll talk about some of these a little bit more soon. So again, the house mouse is here. You see it's very closely related to the rat within the whole scope of the rodent order. And remember that Gene Leitner was suggesting that the kind is the level of the order. When as a geneticist, when you think about this claim, and it is at least is definitely mainstream that the claim that the kind is the level of the family. But when you go up to the order, it's really a remarkable claim. When you think about the kind of genetic differences that you see, even in this case, within closely related genera, you see a similar kind of diversity as you see between humans and some of the other apes. So the claim that all members of an order are the same kind is really remarkable. So this is one interesting feature of this tree is that the branch lengths. So on my kind of assumptions of what I would expect to see on something like a creationist picture, you should expect to see clusters separated by long branch lengths, by long distances. At least in the ideal world, the mouse kind should be a distinct cluster, which is separated from other kinds. But it doesn't look like it on this tree. If we think the kind is some subset of this tree, some of the longest branch lengths are the genera. And there's not many creationists who say that different genera are separate kinds. Now, so we don't see a long branch length at like the family level or something, which would be what I personally would expect on a non-common descent view. So this is the challenge for the non-common descent view, as I see it. Also, the signal is quite consistent across genes. So what I did here is I found 1,000 genes in the mouse musculus, and I compared it to these different animals and found how many of these genes have a match. And then what's the average, the median match percentage for the aligned portions of these genes. And we see that as you get further and further away in the tree, as you would expect, the number of genes decreases and the median percentage identity also decreases. In other words, life really is a nested hierarchy at the molecular level. And that's what we see in this plot, that these are arranged down the page. That's the same as going across the page, across the x-axis on the graph. Further and further away means you get the proteins are less and less similar. And with no kind of obvious big jump between the different groups. So this is the challenge. And you can interpret this as you like. There could be a plausible explanation, but I think we just should accept that this is a challenge, as I see it. So this is similar to one of the animals I showed before. It's similar to this one. They're both elephant shrews. This one just happens to have had its whole genome sequenced. And if we do the analysis, we see that this is remarkably more similar to an elephant than it is to a mouse. It's relatively similar. It's in a different order, but it's in a relatively close order within the superorder Afrotheria, which is a different superorder than the house mouse is. So if you see these numbers, if you compare them to the difference between the mouse and here, so the point is that these numbers are higher. That's the basic point of this. I just find it remarkable that this little mouse with a little extended nose is kind of trying to be an elephant, it almost seems. But it's really not, but it's more similar than it is to a mouse. Even more remarkable is that this marsupial mouse, which if you saw it running across your living room, you'd think that's a mouse in my house, but it's actually a marsupial. It's quite a different kind of mammal. And it's more closely related to a koala, which doesn't look very much like a mouse, than it is to a house mouse. And I find this remarkable, and I think it fits with the picture of common descent. So what? Well, my conclusion from this data that I just briefly summarized is that the various taxonomic levels are meaningful. They do show a real nested hierarchy and plausibly, I would say, a phylogenetic relationship. And if they don't, and I'm very much open to this. I went into my studies thinking this, not really being aware of this data, I guess, into even through my PhD, not recognizing the strength of this data. Maybe there's some other way to account for it, and that's fine. I'm open to hearing that. But I think we should accept this. This makes sense. It's not stupid to believe that there's a relationship between these things when you look at the nature of the nested hierarchy among them. Okay, so that's the pattern. I think it's helpful to distinguish between the pattern of evolution, which is something like a nested hierarchy, and the processes. And can we say anything about the processes? I think I mentioned this graph last year, if you heard my talk last year, but it's worth repeating. This is a really nice article at BioLogos. And of course, I don't recommend all articles at BioLogos. I don't recommend their theology necessarily. But this article is really nice from a leading genetics researcher, Stephen Schaffner, who's also a Christian. And he nicely explains that when you study the different classes of mutation we see in this graph, and I'll have a next slide which explains it a little bit more. If you see the different classes of mutation, if you compare different humans in the human population, you see the same ratios of the different classes of mutation. If you compare humans to humans, humans to chimps, humans to orangutans, etc., again and again, you see the same pattern of differences between genome alignments. And this makes perfect sense if the differences are ultimately due to mutations. We expect for biochemical reasons that there'll be more transition mutations than the other classes of mutations. And this is exactly what we find. I repeated this basically the same analysis using mice. And just for time reasons, because it takes a while to align these genomes, I just did it with the X chromosome of a few of these different species. The Mus musculus versus Mus caryli, the same genus. Mus musculus versus Microtus aqua augusta. These are in different families and in orange, different orders. And again, we see that the transition mutations are much more common than the other mutations, even though in theory, the transition includes four categories. if things were completely equal, if differences were equal with regards in relation to mutations, then these bars and these bars should be the same, and these ones should be half the size. So the same, basically, pattern of mutation is found across mammals. And so it looks like the differences between genomes are due to mutation. That's the conclusion that seems reasonable on the basis of this kind of analysis. Again, maybe there's other analyses that dispute that, but it's not a dumb inference based on what we see, based on comparing genomes. So some people say, okay, the tree doesn't really have any support, or it's just cherry-picked, or it's something. I don't think that's true, because like when I look at the data, I see the nested hierarchy. It's much less clear in the case of prokaryotes, and that actually makes sense when they have extensive horizontal gene transfer. But that's not the point of my talk. I just want to focus today on, do mice and elephants share common descent? If they do and other things don't, you know, that's fine. But if a mouse and an elephant shares a common ancestor, then, you know, a lot of evolution has happened, whatever else you think about the distant past. And I think often these kind of discussions actually get distracted by talking about things which aren't really what people care about. People care about whether mice and elephants and obviously humans and other creatures have common ancestor, or at least show signatures of common ancestor. And talking about whether bacteria and archaea share a common ancestor is very interesting and closer to my research topic, but not really what I think not really what people care about. So again, this is a similar point. If you read discussions, debates about this, you'll see that there are a bunch of scientific papers that dispute the tree of life, but they do it at the root. They do it at the difference between archaea and bacteria, usually. So it's true that this root relationship, going back something like 4 billion years, is disputed and unclear indeed. But I would suggest this is relatively irrelevant to the question of whether mice and elephants, something like 100 million years ago, share a common ancestor. And that's the focus of this talk. And it's not super surprising that going back 4 billion years is less clear, particularly dealing with prokaryotes, than something going back 100 million years. Another major objection, which we could spend half a day talking about, is orphan genes. Orphan genes are found in one or a few genomes. They're often proposed to be a challenge for common descent. My response to that, and very quickly, is that these genes are found at all taxonomic levels. Like I suggested before, they're found, even for SARS-CoV-2, they're found at the species level. They're found at the subspecies level, also, this is I believe, true in other organisms. At least they're definitely found within the same genus level. Creationists now tend to be saying the kind is maybe the family level. So these are found below the family level. They seem, in other words, to be very young. They seem to have evolved recently. Of course, if you think the Earth is young, then the problem is more difficult, because the time available for this kind of evolution or origin is smaller. I hope this argument makes sense. If it's not clear, maybe we can discuss it. This is an example from our work in bacteria, showing an overlapping gene which is restricted to probably a subset of Pseudomonas aeruginosa, again, a subset of a species. At least it's definitely restricted to a single species of bacterium. And there's many of these examples, and this gene has very good evidence of expression as a protein, and seems to even be under purifying selection, suggesting it has a function for the cell. And there's many examples of these, of young genes which seem to be functionally important and need to be accounted for in some way. So I don't think this is particularly a challenge for evolution. It's a challenge for everyone. There's also various objections from large numbers that are proposed. There are large numbers around sequence, around finding a functional protein in sequence space. My quick response to that, and this is, again, a huge topic that we could spend, in this case, a couple of days talking about, but we really don't know some of these numbers. We don't know that they apply to all proteins. We have reasonably good evidence they apply to some proteins, but we can't extrapolate this to all proteins. particularly short proteins. And again, we find many young genes, which do seem to have arisen through natural processes. Okay. There's also an analysis from Winston Ewart, which has been proposed to invalidate common descent. My very quick response to this is this was not based on the kind of data that I was looking at today, which is sequence data. Instead, it was based on just presence and absence of genes, which is problematic because of problems in annotation in the databases. And the real challenge for the opponent of common descent to deal with is the pattern of sequence similarity between organisms. Another massive topic, which deserves a lot more time, is the question of junk DNA. Is junk DNA a myth invented by evolutionists? No, it's actually an incredibly complicated topic. Continues to be debated in the detailed methylogenetics literature. If people are interested, I think these are the three papers on the right they should look at. I wrote a paper about it a couple of years ago, but it was really not very good. And the situation has changed since then. And these are some recent papers that I recommend people who are interested in this topic can look at. I can send you my slides if you want more details. Okay, more helpful question responses just from soon after Darwin. One of them was from Asa Gray. I agree with his contention that the question of evolution leaves the question of design just where it was before. Ultimately, it's a question of chance versus design. And whether you have evolution or not doesn't matter. That's a detailed argument to make, which I began to make last year. I'll be making it with Roope Kujonen at this YouTube channel soon. And he has a bunch of papers, and we're working on this topic at the moment. But basically, we think that evolution doesn't remove the ultimate need for design because the evolutionary process seems to be fine-tuned. That's a very brief version of that. And this kind of argument was made way back in 1876 by Asa Gray, soon after Darwin's work. There's a bunch of other early responses that I find helpful, a couple of them thanks to Richard Buggs and his really excellent article recently, though maybe he'll disagree with my conclusions here, I'm not sure. But there's a bunch of people in the late 19th century who thought really carefully about this and accepted the evidence of common descent that Darwin proposed, or at least found it somewhat plausible, and thought it could be accommodated within some kind of framework of design, where God's designing the processes, he's designing the laws. And I won't go through these in detail, but here are just some examples of some of the leading scientists, apologists at the time, who incorporated some kind of designed evolution or progressive creation, where there's progressive development through time, into their view of the interaction between science and Christian faith. In summary here, I think the evolution doesn't require giving up natural theology. This is a book from my friend Roope Kujonen, which is coming out later this year, which goes into this in depth. And I think it's worth checking out this line of argument. One specific example, right at the very end, which I find really interesting, is it seems like nature is set up to do something like protein engineering. So there's a group, Hecht et al., who do a lot of this work where they have random sequence libraries. They try and get functional proteins out of random sequence libraries. And they see that this is really difficult because, as most of us know, most random sequences, the vast majority, don't fold into functional proteins. But it turns out if you bias the libraries in certain ways, then you are much more likely to get a functional protein, or at least a foldable protein. So this is what they do. They construct these libraries that that have certain basic parameters. They have a certain pattern of hydrophobic and hydrophilic amino acids, but it's not specified what the hydrophobic or hydrophilic amino acid is. When they do that, they can pull out proteins, which they can then design a bit further, and they can get functional proteins out of this kind of system. And it turns out, at least it seems to me, that this is what evolution is doing as well. The standard genetic code is set up so that frameshift mutations preserve the pattern of hydrophobicity. This is a paper in PNAS from last year, which shows that when you frameshift a protein, you tend to get the protein sequence with similar hydrophobicity patterns. So it seems to me that evolution is set up as kind of a protein engineering factory in this way, that the same methods that were rationally designed by protein engineers to find functional sequence space are built into the genetic code. And if people have more questions on that, I would be very happy to talk about it. In conclusion, common descent of widely divergent organisms is well supported by genomic evidence. The evidence must not be misrepresented for the sake of integrity, but also for the sake of apologetics and discipleship. We're setting people up to fail if we tell them that evolution is completely made up, there's no evidence for it. And then they'll go to their biology lectures and they'll hear some of this stuff, and it will be persuasive for a lot of them. And that's a real problem, I think, that whatever your take on the origins issue needs to be dealt with. I think evolution and design don't need to be in conflict. Of course, there's a lot of questions that remain after this, and you can contact me here if you want to. So thank you.